on weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Big thanks to the two Johnnies. It's Friday, the 22nd of September, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up today, Mike Prendergast on a pivotal World Cup weekend for Irish rugby as we take on South Africa in Paris. In soccer, it's kick-off in the Women's Nations League with an All-Ireland derby in the Aviva Stadium tomorrow. We'll hear from the Republic of Ireland camp, and Alan Cawley and Fergal Brennan will set us up for the Premier League weekend and the League of Ireland action. Plus, we've Jane Mangan on racing, and Greg Allen is tracking Leona Maguire at the Solheim Cup. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet us at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Now, welcome along. There is one game underway in the Rugby World Cup today. Argentina are playing Samoa, 52 minutes gone, and it is Argentina 13, Samoa 3 points. And just a few bits of news to bring you, well, to the Women's Ireland team. Celtic defender Caitlin Hayes has declared for the Republic of Ireland. The 28-year-old has been training with interim boss Eileen Gleeson's squad this week ahead of the UEFA Nations League doubleheader against Northern Ireland and Hungary. So she's eligible through her awfully born grandfather, and she has secured her Irish citizenship and could make the matchday squad for tomorrow's clash with the North at the Aviva. Alan Cawley will be on with us later, and we'll be chatting to him about that. And we'll also be chatting to him about Galway United, who will secure the League of Ireland First Division title tonight if they avoid defeat to Kerry. Premier Division leader Shamrock Rovers are away to UCD, and second place at Derry are travelling to Sligo, where Alan Cawley will be. We'll also be catching up with him down there. Now we are going to get straight into the Solheim Cup. Greg Allen is standing by. Greg, it hasn't gone to script for Team Europe. How have things been unfolding throughout the day?
Well, firstly, this morning was a disaster for Europe. They lost all four of the foursomes, and they just didn't fire at all. They came out curiously, not subdued, but just like they didn't really get going for the first couple of hours, and they were behind in all four matches by around 2 hours into the session. And in the end, they lost all four matches. The very top match, Lexi Thompson and Megan Kang beat the rookie partnership for Europe. And this was a strange one, to see two rookies play for Europe in the very first match out on a Friday morning in foursomes. Now, they're very good rookies. Maya Stark and Lynn Grant have played together on amateur teams with Sweden and have been unbeaten through a huge amount of their career. So it seemed like a good idea, but experiences of Solheim Cup are a lot different to amateur golf or anything else. 20,000 fans, very, very partisan type of atmosphere. It's like a Ryder Cup. And there was a very steep learning curve for Maya Stark and Lynn Grant. They were three down after three holes. And while they got back to all square and it looked like they had the momentum, they ended up losing 2-1 to Lexi Thompson and Megan Kang. Second match out, Danielle Kang and Andrea Lee, they defeated Celine Boutier and Georgia Hall, one up on the 18th green. This was the best match in terms of golf of all four this morning. Boutier and Hall played pretty well. Boutier played particularly well, but Kang and Lee won it on 18. They, you know, it's a case of, you know, a very tight match coming down to the odd putt here and there, and that really was what it was. Two teams who played well, but the Americans won the second match out. Similar the case in the Leona Maguire and a Nordqvist match. Nordqvist hit two drives basically into lost ball places, so that didn't help their cause. In the end, Maguire putted really, really well and played quite well, but putted particularly well, holding from 8 feet on the 16th green, from 20 feet on the 17th green to keep the match alive. And if Maguire and Nordqvist could have birdied the final hole, a par 5, which was reachable in two, they would have snatched a half out of it, but they couldn't do that. Maguire hit a wedge shot to around 15 feet, and Nordqvist, in all fairness, didn't even come close to holding the 15 foot, and they end up losing to Nelly Korda and Alison Corpuz. Now, Nelly Korda is the world number three. Alison Corpuz is the US Open champion. So Maguire and Nordqvist were really up against it there. And then in the fourth match out this morning, this one was an absolute lost match from very, very early on. There were six down after nine, Charlie Hull and Emily Pedersen of Denmark, and they lost 5-4 to Ali Ewing and Cheyenne Knight. So America took all of the morning foursomes. That has not been done by America in a morning foursomes first day of the Solheim Cup in history, and it's only ever been done once before by the Americans, taking all 4 points from any session whatsoever in the previous 17 matches dating back to 1990. So that's how, you know, seismic a morning it was in terms of shaping this match. The Americans 4 points to nil up. That's still the score on the master scoreboard. But the afternoon four balls are doing well. They're going a bit better for Europe. They look very, very good in the bottom match on the golf course. And this is Carlotta Shiganda and Lynn Grant. The Spaniard and the Swede are three up on Angel Ying and Ali Ewing with four holes to play. Fingers crossed that's going to be Europe's point. The other three matches could all go pretty much either way. The top match, Rose Zhang and Megan Kang for America, all square with Gemma Drybera and Madeline Sagstrom. They're now playing the 18th. Leona Maguire and Georgia Hall, they're actually one up on Lexi Thompson and Lilia Vu with two to play. So Maguire and Hall, Maguire has just played really, really well. As the day has gone on, she played fine this morning, but she's played really well this afternoon. She's played better than Hall, although Hall did put the European pairing up with a birdie on the fourth. But from there on, it was Maguire holding them together. And that's currently on the card, and Maguire is four shots better than Hall. And they've got to the point where they're playing the 17th hole now. And Maguire and Hall are one up on Lexi Thompson and Lilia Vu. Lilia Vu, incidentally, has won two major golf championships this year, and Lexi Thompson is one of the modern legends of the game. So this is a big, big point if Europe can bring that one up. Maguire and Hall, one up with two to play on Thompson and Vu. In the third match out, this has been an extraordinary match for Europe, because Emily Pedersen did not play terribly well this morning with Charlie Hull, and neither did Maria Stark play particularly well with Lynn Grant. But they are only one down against Jennifer Kupcho and Alison Corpuz with three holes to play, and Pedersen had a hole in one to keep that match alive on the 12th. So fingers crossed, possibly a half there, possibly even a European victory, but the Americans are up in that match. So as it stands, Europe are up in two, America up in one, one match is all square. If it remained like that going into tomorrow, Europe would have a 3-point deficit, which is really doable in terms of coming back from that. But after that 4-point loss this morning, it really is a rearguard action by Europe. And the next hour is going to be critical to how this Solheim Cup evolves if Europe are going to have a chance to win it for the third time in a row. And Europe have never won the Solheim Cup three times in a row.
Greg, what are you putting down this fast start, this American fast start to? Or are we looking at it as a slow start by Europe?
Bit of both, but I think it was a fast start by America. I thought one thing was really notable this morning. Even when the Americans saw this European sort of mini fight back in the middle of the morning foursomes, the Americans were notable for not dropping the head at all. All of them seemed to smile through the adversity. And it's like they were given an instruction by Stacey Lewis, never, don't show weakness to the opposition. And while they were going through that period when Europe actually came back and looked like they might even snatch a 2-2 scenario from the morning session, the Americans just ploughed on, and they were kind of weathering the storm. And when it came down to the last few holes, they were the stronger. And I think Europe came out fairly tamely by comparison, even in the first hour and a half of play, when they were down in all four matches. And when you see red on the board, which is the American colour, blue is the European colour to have on the board, but when you see all the matches in red, which means all four matches for America are ahead, it has a psychological effect that you're playing rear guard for, you know, the morning and trying to get back and snatch something from the session. Whereas America had this feeling that we can take all 4 points here. So the psychological element of a team starting quickly and a team starting sluggishly, and Europe did start sluggishly. They didn't seem to be in it. They didn't hold putts. It was very notable the way that the Americans hold more putts. And when it comes down to it, this team format, putting is just so much what it's all about. Ryder Cup, Solheim Cup, President's Cup, all the same, it's down to putting. And the Americans putted vastly better than the Europeans this morning, and that's why, to some degree, Europe found themselves 4 points to nil down at lunchtime, and they're still in that situation. I think they'll be doing really well to get out of this first day to be behind 5.5 to 2.5, which is the case if you froze the scoreboard right now. That would be the scenario, and I'd take that right now and run away with it.
And Greg, just before we finish up, what's it like in terms of crowd, atmosphere as an event and all that?
Well, okay, it started off brilliantly, and I have to say, like, the difference between the Solheim Cup and the Ryder Cup is marginal. Maybe bigger crowds at the Ryder Cup, maybe more vocal, but there's a particular feeling about the Solheim Cup. There isn't that degree of animosity, tribal animosity. It's really good-humoured, high-intensity atmosphere, and it's a lovely, lovely atmosphere. It's great to watch. It's a fantastically entertaining format. You can't keep your eyes away from it. I looked away for a moment there, and Emily Pedersen had a hole-in-one, and then I looked away for another moment, doing some notes, and the Gemma Drybera hold from 50 yards. And you know, the roars go up and you respond to it. And, you know, even major golf championships, they don't offer that many moments. There are so many, you know, electric moments in this format of team golf that, you know, we've got the Solheim Cup this week, the Ryder Cup next week. It's a feast.
Well, it's on my bucket list, so hopefully I'll get you at some stage. Greg Allen, thank you so much, and we'll be talking to you over the weekend, no doubt.
Cheers. Thanks Marie. Greg.
2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. We're going to turn our attention to rugby. And before we get the thoughts of Munster attack coach Mike Prendergast, let's hear from the Irish camp where Mac Hansen has been speaking today.
It's probably everything that you kind of dream of when you're growing up playing in these sort of games. You don't know if it's ever going to happen. So for something like this to finally come around, playing a World Cup against the defending champions is, as I said, it's just something that you kind of, you always hope to be involved in. And to get this opportunity, get this chance to play with this team, no, it's super special. And a few nerves here and there, but that's kind of what it's all about. Well, the rugby is kind of made for these sort of games. To be involved in it is incredible, and yeah, pretty special to be playing alongside players like Josh and Johnny and stuff like that as well. Some guys in their third, fourth World Cup. This is kind of what we've been working for. We're super excited for it. It's a big step up from the previous games we've had, but yeah, as I said, it's everything we've been working for this whole time.
So that was the view from the Irish camp today. I'm now joined by Mike Prendergast to look ahead to this huge game tomorrow night against South Africa. Mike, it feels like we've been building up to this for years almost, but it's finally here. How are you feeling about this Ireland team now heading into the South Africa game?
I'm very excited, Marie, to be honest with you. As you said there, it's something we've all been looking forward to for a long while now, and tomorrow is the day. So I think just, do you know what, I suppose the beauty about this game is just how tactically brilliant it's going to be from both sides, you know, in terms of how they set up, even in terms of obviously the benches, etc. Ireland haven't veered away from what they've been so good at, and rightly so. You know, I think you look at Andy Farrell and the decisions he's made over the last couple of years, number of years, and he hasn't been too far wrong. I heard, was it yesterday, that it's 27 out of the last 29 games they've won. So that's a remarkable record, you know, of wins. So, and, you know, coming up against the mighty South Africans will be, it's a mouth-watering affair to look forward to.
It really is. And look, as you said there, that Andy Farrell, he hasn't veered, like he hasn't really put a foot wrong in the last number of games anyway, that's for sure. How would you say he's evolved tactically with this Ireland team?
I just think they've in terms of their attack especially, you know, they've so many options, they've so many threats. Everybody's really, really comfortable on the ball. So it's easy, you know, to I suppose implement an attack framework and you know, have a philosophy, but you need the players to do that, and you've got to see what skill set suits the type of game plan you have. And with Ireland, I think, you know, he said he stole a couple of years ago about how they wanted to play. They've evolved a huge amount, and you strip it back a small bit, and you look at it and you say, when you're playing that type of game, you got to play with speed. And as it's been well alluded to before, he made a good decision in bringing someone like Paul O'Connell in, who around that breakdown has been really, really efficient in how we want to play. So, as I said, they're really, really set up to challenge, I think, South Africa and how they defend tomorrow. As I said, there'll be tactical battles going on off the pitch, obviously, but more importantly, on the pitch. And that's something, I suppose, that's a huge reason why I'm looking forward to it, and I'm sure everybody else is.
Just given, I suppose, the calibre of players that we're going to see out in the pitch tomorrow night, it really has people so excited about it. What do you think are going to be the key matchups now tomorrow?
I think, look, it's like every game. I think, especially when you play someone like South Africa, you've got to match them and meet them up front, you know. And that's going to be, I suppose, you can say where it's going to be won or lost, but it will have a huge outcome. Ireland's line out the last, it was really, really impressive, and what they did off it in terms of their little patterns, their little power plays, and it got a couple of scores from it. And it was through the middle they did it, you know. So, you know, I know playing against South African teams, you play South Africa, they give you edges, and it's how you get into them, you know. So, but sometimes it's actually through them that can cause more problems. And again, as I said, the way Ireland are set up, they can afford to go there in terms of between the 15s causing problems. And then that space, I suppose, I won't say it opens up, but space to go to becomes a small bit more clearer and a small bit more easy. And at times, you know, they might need to go to that space. So the way they set up with with three forwards and a back and three forwards and a back, or sometimes two forwards and a back between the 15s. Short passing, really, really well connected. And against a big South African team who, you know, they're big men in terms of they scramble very well, but beating them on those front doors options, I think, is something that Ireland will tactically go after tomorrow. And obviously you add in the little, I suppose, offensive kicking game that they'll bring, the likes of Johnny, who sees that very, very well because of South Africans' high rush up. And a big, I think, tactical, I suppose, challenge tomorrow will be, if we do go to the edge, that not to go too far. When I say the edge, out to the wings, basically, not to go too far into them. I suppose Scotland did that. The South Africa created or forced Scotland to make a lot of rucks towards the 5 metres, which in turn allows, you know, 12, 13 players on their feet. And that's what they want, you know. So it'll be interesting to see when Ireland do go to those edges, that they don't go too deep in them to create rucks, maybe in around the 15. So you've kind of both sides of the ruck to attack from, and I suppose just outsmart them. But I've no doubt Ireland will have a plan set up that, in terms of how they're set up, how they'll go after that South African team.
You mentioned Johnny Sexton there, and he's obviously been lauded at the moment because he's just looking so sharp in those opening two games, and we hadn't seen him for so long. You obviously have been watching him for a number of years now. What is it about him right now that's different, that's making him look as good as he is?
I think it's just his calmness, and more importantly, it's his decision making. But the decision making comes with that calmness, and vice versa. You know, he's never a guy in play that looks stressed. You know, at times he's challenging moments, referees, etc. But that's his competitive nature. But when the ball is in play, he's just, the calmness out of him is something that really sticks out to me. And just along with that calmness is just those decisions he makes under pressure, whether it's a, you know, generally a short pass or a little kick pass into space. And he just expects around him, you know, he expects people to be on the same wavelength and same page. And that's where Ireland are at the moment, you know, in terms of their skill set, in terms of their decision making. You know, you look at even the two games that they've played already in the World Cup, they've managed to score 20 tries. That's a lot of tries in two games. I know you can talk about the opposition, but to score 20 tries in two games is pretty impressive. So the thing is, with Ireland, they'll always fire shots. And I think it come down to, you know, a game of who'll score the most tries. And at the moment, if you're to ask me, I just think Ireland are set up to do that.
Everyone is obsessed with the 7-1 split on the South African bench. And Andy Farrell says that he loves it. He respects it. It's their call. It suits their players. Paul O'Connell said something similar as well. But when it happens, or when the bomb squad arrive, how will Ireland cope with that?
I think, you know what? Absolutely, there's a bomb squad to come off the bench. I think Ireland's bench looks very, very strong as well, you know. And I think there might be a little tactical decision there. We're putting Dan Sheehan on the bench. You know, possibility or probability it would be himself and, you know, Ian Henderson, these guys would come off with 30 minutes to go, come off the bench. And so I think, look, 7-1 it's obviously a topic that's been well discussed this week. It's risky. I find it actually even more exciting going into the game. You know, they've won back on the bench, South Africa do, in Cobus Reinach. There's talks, you know, that they spoke it up that Quagga Smith has played sevens. But at this level of rugby, when you're coming against a team tactically, I suppose, equipped like Ireland are, you've got a 10 who's tactically, you know, probably the best in the world at the moment. He'll pick out those frailties if there is. So there will be a bit of shifting around. You know, the ideal scenario is that 7 forwards come on, but it might be always that way. So, and I do believe that, and I suppose the part I like about it is, even though South Africa named their squad on Tuesday, it would have been very easy for other coaches or other squads to maybe, you know, veer away from what they were used to with the 5-3. And he hasn't. And he's right too. You know, they are the number one team at the moment in the world. They're feared. And as I said, I keep going back to, he hasn't made too many bad decisions over the last number of years. So again, I go back to it, talk about the tactical. You know, you've an all-out attack against a very good defensive side. It's depending, as I said, where you create rucks, where you go after them, and it's just, yeah, it's a game that really looking forward in terms of a tactical battle.
Manny Libbock is obviously under a bit of scrutiny. His goal kicking isn't where it should be, and I suppose especially when you compare him to Johnny Sexton. But he said himself he's very much focused on his all-round game, and other players have come out and defended him. Is he a weakness, do you think?
No, not at all. He's an outstanding footballer, to be honest with you. His skill set is very threatening. He's got a really, really good short kicking game. I know we've seen it already in the World Cup, looking at the Stormers over the last kind of year or two, what he brings to them. And it's off unstructured kind of turnover ball, which will happen in games. You would hope there isn't too many tomorrow night, especially the way Ireland, as I said, are set up in terms of their attacking shape, which allows them to be really clear and accurate around their ruck. And because they have a huge amount of threats on the ground, they look for that. And you look at their bench with, you know, a couple of back rows. You've Dion Farise, a back row at hooker. Quagga Smith, as I said, they have players in the last 20 minutes, half an hour, that will come on that will look to really disrupt Ireland's breakdown. And it's off that kind of unstructured stuff that they come alight. And Manny Libbock is a massive part of that. Look, obviously there's questions over his kicking ratio. You look at the Scotland game, I think it was 5. He converted 2 out of the 5, which, you know, I suppose when it comes to this type of rugby, probably isn't where it needs to be. And that kind of leads me on to as well in terms of, you know, obviously if you don't want them scoring tries, but the other way they score is through penalties. And that's probably an area that Ireland would have focused an awful lot on this week in terms of giving 13 penalties away against Tonga, which is a lot, you know. And it might come down to, you know, a captain making a decision that he goes to the corner instead of going for the post, and we know what their maul can bring, you know. So they have a lot of huge amount of strengths and to the game, and I do believe Manny Libbock is part of that.
Okay, so then what are their weaknesses if they have many strengths?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think you know what, I think Ireland will look at their strengths more so, and I think defensively it's an area they're you know, it's renowned how strong they are, defensively how well connected they are. They have a brilliant scramble defence, but I do think Ireland with their short passing can cause problems. They're bigger men. When you pass the ball and it's not in the air long, it's harder to make decisions defensively. So you look at Scotland, for example, a lot went through Finn Russell, quite long passes. It, you know, kind of played into their hands a small bit. Ireland, tactically, the way they play, the way they're set up, I think it's something that will really challenge, I suppose, those bigger forwards in that in between those two 15s, that we can get in behind them. And then it's about playing on top of them. Playing on top of them with that, with our quick ruck, and exploiting that space, and just being patient, because, you know, you're not going to score early off them. And the biggest thing about being patient is having a good ruck, so you can rely on your ruck. And it's something that, you know, Ireland have had in terms of ruck speed and amount of rucks that we've had over the last kind of 2 or 3 seasons. It's been a huge weapon of ours. But look, the South Africans is they'll be through Razi and Jacques, they'll be massively focused, obviously, on set piece, their kicking game, but they know the one area you can really go after Ireland to stop what they want to do is slowing down that ball.
And just in terms of their opening 2 games as well, they were a little bit patchy initially, a bit slow to start. Do you think they're going to be able to sort that issue out before tomorrow?
Ireland or South Africa, Ireland. That is. Ireland. Sorry?
Just at Ireland, that they were a little bit patchy in their opening few minutes and took them a little bit to settle. Are they going to be able to settle quickly, do you think?
I think so. Again, it'll be a part of the game, an aspect they'll have spoken about a huge amount. And, you know, especially against South Africa, you don't want to, I suppose, give them a lead, leave them get in front, because that's when they look to squeeze you and look to, I suppose, to put pressure on you an awful lot. So it's hugely important. And I know from speaking to players and coaches that were with Razi, it was a big aspect of his philosophy. First 20 minutes, get out there and cause problems. And Ireland know. And you know what? Sometimes I've said it, you learn from experience. So as you alluded to, the 2 first games, it was an area probably that they did start slow, but it's something that I think they'll learn from, and they know in this game there will be a huge knock-on effect if they don't.
So I have a couple more things I just want to get to on. But first of all, before I move on to Antoine Dupont and his injury, give me a prediction.
Ireland by six.
Whoa, okay. You're feeling very confident.
Yeah, 5 or 6 points, yeah.
That's really interesting because of the fact that they've, you know, they haven't been at their best at World Cups. But I guess, look, it's different. It's different now. It feels a little bit different as well.
This is a different team, as I keep alluding to, the way they're set up. They're going to fire shots. They've a different mentality. They've, you know, in terms of injuries, they've very little. Like Dan Sheehan coming back. I think they're in a good place. And as I said, you know, confidence is a magic portion in sport. And when you score 20 tries, irrespective of the opposition or not, I thought their last outing against Tonga, they looked ruthless. They did everything we speak about, you know, in terms of short passing, creating. I suppose stressing defences, playing with speed. They kind of showed everything against Tonga, and they know they can lift that up another edge, which I'm sure, or which we're all hoping for tomorrow night.
Absolutely. So look, one of the things that always comes into play as well is having a fit team, and so far so good, fingers crossed. Ireland have had a fit squad, but France haven't been so lucky, and the latest casualty is Antoine Dupont. He'd suffered a facial fracture during their win against Namibia last night, their huge win, 96-0 win last night. Do you think he'll get back? You'd know a little bit more about injuries now than I would, and if not, how big a loss? How would they even cope without him?
Yeah, hard to know. He is a tough little cookie, naturally. But it'd be really, really hard to know. Will he make it through? You know, potentially for, I would imagine he would be out of the Italian game. At this stage, I wouldn't think that he would be fit. I don't think they would risk him. It depends on a quarter final, if they get to a semi final. It's a hard one to know. I haven't heard enough about it yet. I was looking at the French media this morning, and it was. Negative enough about his injury after all the positivity of, you know, the performance. I thought the way they played, I thought the variety in their game. I know Namibia, I suppose, in terms of a challenge, didn't put it up the way they wanted to, but I just thought France were ruthless. You kind of saw what happens when they get that flow and that atmosphere that was going on in the stadium. It just lifts them. And even listening to Rafael Ibanez afterwards, he was speaking about the crowd more than anything. I know he was trying to deflect off the injury of Antoine Dupont, but they're building. The French are, look, you lose Antoine Dupont out of any team, it's going to be massive. Absolutely. Especially on top of Romain Ntamack, who'd lost before the competition. Absolutely. They have guys coming in, but Antoine Dupont is a once in a generational player, I think, you know, so it'll be a huge loss for them. It just depends on how long it's for.
Okay, Mike Prendergast, thank you so much for joining us.
RTE
2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Just 4 minutes to play in the Argentina-Samoa game. Argentina winning by 16 points to 10. It's time to talk football now. And I'm delighted to say that I'll be joined by Alan Cawley and Fergal Brennan. I'm going to go to you first, Al, just for a quick chat about the League of Ireland, because it is a big night. Shamrock Rovers are away to UCD. Second place Derry, travelling to Sligo. So I guess in ways, given UCD's form, all eyes will be on the showgrounds tonight.
Yeah, that's why I'm down here, Marie. Big game in the showgrounds tonight. At both ends of the table, really, as you say, Sligo Rovers find themselves right in the mire. They had a victory last week against UCD, which gives them a little bit of breathing space. But, of course, Cork City are playing Shelburne. They're 6 points behind them, and Cork City have a game in hand that they'll play out on Monday night. So it's a huge weekend. And then, of course, Derry City, as you say, are under real pressure to not let Shamrock Rovers gain any ground, really. They're already 4 points clear after the draw last week, and if they were to extend that lead by beating UCD and Derry not getting the job done tonight, you would think the league will be all but over. So huge pressure on both teams to try and get 3 points tonight, so I'm looking forward to the game.
Yeah, look, different things at stake for Sligo Rovers and Derry City, but just given the history, the rivalry and all that, Al, should it be a cracker?
It should be on paper, really, Marie. Yeah, there should be a huge crowd. Now, obviously, it's different for Sligo Rovers. It'll be interesting to see how much the change of night that they play the game I suppose, impacts the attendance, because normally they always play on a Saturday evening, but tonight obviously they're playing on Friday because there's games on Monday night as well. So that'll be interesting to see. But the fact that it's Derry City and Town, as you say, Northwest rivalry, that's been going back a long, long time, desperate for the points, really, and everybody feels that around the town. There was huge fundraising done with the annual draw to raise over 100,000, which, despite the turmoil on the pitch, it's still a huge reflection of just the support base that they have off the pitch, because that was an amazing figure that they raised and fundraised themselves, obviously, over the last few weeks, and they had the annual draw last week. But it's all about what's on the pitch, and as I say, they've had a terrible season all year, and they find themselves right in the middle of that relegation battle. So it's important that they get some sort of a point or points from the game tonight, but it'll be a tough ask, because Derry are very, very good, breeding down the necks of Shamrock Rovers, and they know themselves, as I outlined, they have to win tonight just to keep the pressure on Shamrock Rovers. So hopefully both teams, with so much at stake, it lends itself to a really good game.
Absolutely. Well, tomorrow then, all eyes will be on the Aviva Stadium, Republic of Ireland against Northern Ireland. A different kind of build-up to this game, lots of focus on the past, but it is very much about the future now and getting that win in the Nations League. Captain Katie McCabe was speaking to the media ahead of the historic clash. Let's hear from her.
No, it'll be a great day out. Of course, for me, family, but everyone's family and friends, fans. But we don't want this to be a once-off thing, do you know what I mean? Obviously, yes, we love Tala. We have created a lot of special memories in Tala. We have great engagement with our fans in Tala, but this is the pinnacle, you know, playing in your national stadium. I'm hoping, maybe we might see this going in the future. Puts a bit of pressure on the FAI, but it's a fantastic thing. Honestly, as Eileen said, myself and the girls, we cannot wait for tomorrow. It's going to be a spectacular day, and we hope we can give the performance and get the results for our fans to be happy with.
37,000 tickets sold for that game tomorrow, and the players have been out all week urging anyone with a ticket to get out and to support the team, because they do want as many people there to mark a special moment as they take to the Aviva Stadium for the first time. But Al, doesn't matter about any of that stuff, it's all about winning the game, isn't it?
Absolutely, Marie, yeah, but it will be a momentous occasion for them. As you say, 37,000 tickets is a remarkable achievement in itself, I suppose, and coming off the back of the success that they've had and getting to the World Cup. I know there's been a cloud hanging over the squad, really, over the managerial situation, but it's about moving on now. That decision has been made. Eileen Gleeson is in situ for the time being, and until a permanent manager is named, but obviously some new members of the coaching staff that have been former players as well. So I'm sure it's going to be an exciting occasion, but as you say, it's all about getting the 3 points and kicking off that Nations League campaign, I suppose, on a positive start, because as we've seen with the Men's Nations League campaign, it does impact the qualification going forward, and that'll be the same for the women. So it's important, despite it being a huge landmark occasion for them, the first time to play in the Aviva bumper crowd, it's important that they get the job done on the football side as well.
Do you think Eileen is going to set up differently to the way Vera set up with being ultra defensive?
I think she has to now. I think, because of all the stick that obviously Vera has taken, and the girls obviously voicing their opinion that they don't want to play a defensive game. The FEI coming out, basically the reason they gave was that Vera is not kind of aligned with our culture and brand of football, the way we see the girls evolving and playing. So I think there'll be huge eyes just on the formation and how to go about their business tomorrow. And if we do see an attacking style, that's not to say that they're going to go out and it'll be all gung-ho, mad attacking football. I'm sure there'll still be a bit of pragmatism attached to it, but you would like to see something different, I suppose, than what we've seen under Vera, because that's, I suppose, where Vera has fallen down, according to the FEI. So there will be a bit of pressure on the girls tomorrow. I know there was obviously a huge reaction to the comments Diane Caldwell made during the week as well, and a lot of it negative around Vera and Diane's comments. So there is a little bit of pressure on the girls tomorrow. So it'll be interesting to see from that point of view how to respond to that as well. But I definitely think in terms of the approach, you will see a different style to what we've seen under Vera.
Okay, and in the other game in Ireland's group that was on this evening, Albania 1, Hungary 1, and that is a full-time result. The game tomorrow will be live on 2FM, so do tune in. I'll be at the Aviva Stadium alongside Mary Curtin and Paul Curry. There is a full card of the Premier League as well, but I guess the big game, Fergal Brennan, is Arsenal against Spurs. Spurs have had a terrible record at the Emirates Stadium. They've only had one win over Arsenal in 17 Premier League games. Do you think that this is going to affect the approach that Ange Postecoglou takes heading to the Emirates tomorrow?
I think there will be a change of approach. As you mentioned, the record that Spurs have away at Arsenal over the last few years has not been great. But I think everything that we've mentioned about Postecoglou since he's come into Spurs is this idea of changes in the way they play, changes in the way that he deals with the players. Fans love him, not just Spurs fans. I'm yet to hear anybody really have anything negative to say about him. He's very affable, he's very engaging, and he's a very, very talented coach. He's not just a kind of press conference kingpin. He knows exactly what he's doing, and he's set Tottenham up in a way that the fans are enjoying and that they're getting the best from their players, and particularly on the back of Harry Kane leaving, that's no mean feat. In terms of this weekend, form, there's not really anything to pick between them. They've both got an identical record so far this season, unbeaten, but obviously Manchester City are out in front because they've won every game. You would tip for Arsenal for the basics, obviously with it being at home. The atmosphere of the Champions League game the other night against PSV was pretty special, and obviously getting back into that competition for the first time in 6 years was huge for them. I don't think there'll be an issue with fatigue from Arsenal. We saw with Arteta, he was kind of packing down in the final stages of that game, bringing off the players that are going to play at the weekend. So Spurs could possibly get a draw. I don't see them winning, if I'm being very honest. But I think this could be a cracker of a draw, or I think Arsenal will win it. But I do think this could be a really, really good game on Sunday. I think this could be a 2-2, a 3-3. But I think if anyone's going to win it, I think it'll be Arsenal.
Al, is this going to be the toughest game that Ange, I'm going to call him Ange, as I call Pep, you know, I'm going to go with Ange, has faced since he's taken over Spurs?
I think we're allowed to call him Big Ange from now on.
All right, okay, we'll go one step further. Why not?
We're going with Big Ange, yeah. Well, he's made such an impact on and off the pitch, really. All the plaudits that he was receiving, and fully justified too in terms of the football side, but off the pitch as well, he's been a revelation with, I suppose, just his kind of laid-back approach. And that's not to say that he doesn't take any nonsense, because he certainly deals with that very kind of strong as well in terms of his approach, as we've seen with a manager before. But I think he's done a remarkable job really since he's come in. But this will be the litmus test to go to Arsenal. You know, I've tipped Arsenal to win the league. As Fergal said, they had a great result during the week in Europe. Arteta's doing a phenomenal job really, and even if you look at the start that they've had, picked up I think 13 points out of 15 without really hitting the heights that we know, that's always a good sign that obviously they're still only kind of getting going and they're still picking up the wins and the points, and none more so than that game against Man United when it looked like United might have even snatched it at the end, but Arsenal still showed character to go and get the victory in injury time. So it will be a huge test for Spurs, but I don't think the approach will change in terms of his football and philosophy. He'll go to Arsenal and take them on, go toe-to-toe, and I think that will make for a brilliant, brilliant game and a brilliant spectacle for us. And I would agree with Fergal that you will see goals. I definitely think with both teams love to play an attacking brand of football, that you'll definitely see goals. And I think Ange would be delighted with even coming out with a point, Marie, because this will be such a tough test, not only this weekend, to have Liverpool then next weekend. So that will really tell a story just where this Spurs team are at.
Fergal, is it a must-win game for Manchester United against Burnley? I know we're only in September.
It's must-win, particularly on the back of the week that they've had. Really exposed in both of their games, Brighton and Bayern Munich. Different reasons for the kind of exposure. I wouldn't say that they're in a kind of crisis mode. I don't think there's any issues with Erik ten Hag and the potential that someone could be knocking on his door. This should be an absolute free hit for them over the weekend. Burnley have found it really, really hard going. I know they're away from home, it's not too much of a far trip over to the other side of Manchester. They should be absolutely fine. But that's more based on Burnley than Manchester United. I don't think we'll learn a lot about United if they go to Turf Moor and win by a goal or two and kind of get a bit of confidence back into them. Brighton, Bayern and more games further down the line in the not-too-distant future will be the big tests for United and Ten Hag. And it's not been a pleasant week. It's not been a pleasant start to the season, really, for them. But this should be pretty straightforward for them tomorrow night.
Al, do you agree?
I don't think it'll be straightforward by any means, to be honest with you, Marie. Just what I've watched in the last couple of weeks, they're an absolute mess, Man United, all over the park. And whatever about the football and ability, just their mentality and their attitude is where I would worry for them, because they'll go to Turf Moor tomorrow where there'll be a massive crowd, massive atmosphere. Company will have them well wound up, all the players. A good, honest bunch of players as well. I know he's tried to change the culture in terms of the football that he's trying to implement. But the one thing that the Burnley I suppose, success has been built on under Sean Dyche is that character and resilience. And now, I don't think this team is as tough as the Sean Dyche teams, but I certainly think they'll be well revved up for the game tomorrow. And I think it'll be difficult. Man United are an absolute mess on and off the pitch. And the one thing, I suppose, the fundamentals and the basics of the game and just running, tackling, fighting, that's all a miss as well. So it's not just in terms of the footballing ability that they're falling down. I think their attitude is a major, major concern. And I'd love to have Fergal's confidence, but I don't think it'll be as straightforward as that.
Okay, guys, I'm afraid that's all we have time for. We have to get to Jane and racing, and I do want to cross back over to Greg at the Solheim Cup. Alan, enjoy the game.
I will, Marie. Thank you.
And Fergal will be talking to you again next week. We're going to take a very quick break, though. Stay with us. We'll have Jane Mangan and Greg Allen to come.
RTE
2FM.
Game on.
Racing.
Now, I'm delighted to say that Jane Mangan joins us on the line to look ahead to all of the weekend's racing. How are you, Jane?
I'm very well. I'm here in Mahon Point Shopping Centre trying to catch a little bit of a recess to do this, and looking forward to the weekend. I will be on duty myself at the Curragh on Sunday.
Before we get to that, I want to find out what yourself and Ruby were up to last night. I saw pictures of you dressed to the absolute nines and looking amazing. It looked like you were somewhere in England. Tell me more.
You're very kind and complimentary. Ruby and Jane sometimes put in a little bit of effort and then we look like shiny pennies. We were hosting the McCoy Awards in Cheltenham yesterday evening, which of course is the National Hunt Awards in the UK. So it was a real treat. Paul Nicholls, Lucinda Russell, Constitution Hill, Honeysuckle, John Bonn, they were all winners on the night. Peter Scudamore picked up the Contribution to the Industry Award, and yeah, it was from start to finish. We enjoyed ourselves on stage, and I hope the people who are watching did a bit as well.
Yeah, well, you looked the part anyway. I don't know how you did, but you definitely seemed to have everything under control. So, Jane, this weekend, what is happening? Where should we be looking to for our racing?
Well, the domestic action, the Listowel Harvest Festival, concludes tomorrow with a National Hunt card. Of course, they've had serious crowds down there during the week. I think nearly 25,000 people went to the Kerry track on Wednesday for their feature Kerry National, which is won by Martin Brazel and Ricky Doyle. They have their final day tomorrow, but really the flat action takes centre stage this weekend, and that is at the Curragh Saturday and Sunday. I would have thought that if Irish fans missed Frankie Dettori at Irish Champions weekend, that they mightn't see him at the Curragh again, but he's back tomorrow for the Goff Million. The race is worth over £1 million for two-year-olds, and he's riding Cherry Blossom for Aidan O'Brien. Cherry Blossom was second in the Lowther at York. She's a very smart filly. She's the highest rated two-year-old in the race, and Frankie Dettori will fancy his chances of taking home a big purse there in the Goff Million. There's six UK raiders in the race from top yards, such as Roger Varian, Andrew Balding and Richard Hannon. Our own home team are well represented here because it's a 23-runner field, four of them saddled by Ger Lyons, three from Jessica Harrington. But Frankie Dettori will be riding Cherry Blossom, and that's the most likely favourite for the Goff Million. You might ask, why is Frankie Dettori riding for Aidan O'Brien this weekend? Well, that is because Ryan Moore is 10,000 miles away. He's riding Shinzo for the Coolmore team in a Group 1 down in Australia, but he will be making the journey back to ride at the Curragh on Sunday. Isn't that crazy? Australia Saturday, Curragh Sunday. He's coming back to ride in the Irish Cesar, which the race has got 30 runners, but is worth a cool €600,000. Willie Mullins is throwing a lot of darts at this race. He's got six representatives, including last year's runner-up Echoes and Rain, Stratum, Mount Leinster and MC Muldoon. Aidan O'Brien only saddled one in this. This is Tower of London. Remember last year, he only saddled one, and that was Waterville, and that was the horse that got up to beat Echoes and Rain. Tower of London has a date in the Melbourne Cup. We don't know if he's going to go. Maybe this will decide. His son Joseph has five in the field, including Nazareth, Dawn Rising and St. Vincent's Garden. But, yeah, I don't know where the Irish are, which is going to go. But if it's worth a cool $600,000, there's going to be a lot of competition for it. On the same card on Sunday, there's a pair of Group 3 races, including the Renaissance Stakes, which features Big Gossie, the course specialist, Chartash for Johnny Murta and Go Atletico, and the Group 3 Well Park Stakes for two-year-olds. I liked the impression I got from Caught You Looking for Noel Mead when she won at Leopardstown. I also liked what I saw from Content in Defeat on Irish Champions weekend as well. So they feature in the Well Park. And we have one other race of interest abroad. If anybody's looking for something outside of domestic action this weekend, Jessica Harrington is sending Trevenants over to Germany, over to Cologne to contest the Prix von Europa, the nine-runner, mile-and-a-half Group 1. Trevenants is teaming up with Holly Doyle, owned by Moigler Stud. This filly is a multiple group winner in France. She's taking on the colts in the Prix von Europa. Tuscany represents Charlie Appleby and William Buick. Live Your Dream for Oisin Murphy, who, of course, was in action in winning form down in Listowel during the week. But just to give you context, Marie, the Prix von Europa is a Group 1 in Cologne in Germany. It's worth £88,000. We have handicapped and two-year-old conditions races at the Curra this weekend, one worth over £1 million and the other worth £600,000. That's why Irish racing is as competitive and it's as difficult to win as it is.
So why is there so much money around this weekend?
Well, it's our HQ track, big track. The Irish Desire, which is a heritage handicap, it's worth a lot of money, but it's also got a legacy to it. And I suppose 30 runners will make up a very competitive field. The Goff's Million is a unique race in that the runners have all gone through the Goff's sales ring and they've all had to pay considerable entry fees, maybe to consolidate the money that they're contesting for. But ultimately, we have good enough prize money here and that is reflected in the level of competition that we have.
Sounds good. And what about Listowel this week? I know it's not over yet, but any highlights for you, Jane?
Well, I was down there on Monday. I just always think the highlight of Listowel is the crowds and the atmosphere. The weather has been inclement at times, but I suppose I would have to give special mention to Oisin Murphy. He fought out a really tight finish down there and he got the margin by a nose. That was, I'm sure, a highlight for Pat O'Donnell, who trained the horse as well. That'll probably be a picture that'll go on the mantelpiece. But Desert Morehouse winning the Kerry National for Martin Braslin and Ricky Doyle was a winner for the good guys. And it's nice to see a big pot like that going to those who maybe don't have 100 or 150 horses in training.
Okay, so Jane, thank you for all of that. We'll talk to you soon. Enjoy the weekend.
Thank you.
Game on. Racing.
Now it's time to return to the Solheim Cup and join Greg Allen. So, Greg, has there been a four-ball fight back?
Oh, what a fight back. well, look, you know, I mean, this is what this team competition is about, you know, and central to the fight back, whatever way you want to put it, it was Leona Maguire. She played well this morning. And in playing well in the morning, she was also on a losing team. That happens. But in this afternoon four ball, she was really inspired. And herself and Georgia Hall earned a victory on the 18th green against Lexi Thompson and Lilia View. And that was because Maguire chipped in on the 18th green. So it was extraordinary. And it was followed by other extraordinary stuff. Carlotta Shiganda in the final match. That match also was, well, it was a point for Europe, but it was a comfortable point for Europe in the end, 4-2. Then Emily Pedersen, and that match was extraordinary insofar as Emily Pedersen of Denmark had a hole-in-one. And the hole-in-one on the 12th hole catapulted the European pair alongside Maya Stark to a half match against Jennifer Kupcho and Alison Corpuz, which didn't look at all likely because Maya Stark came to the 18th green just about 5 minutes ago with a 10-foot putt, having clawed their way back, helped by a hole-in-one, and she holed the 10-foot putt, and she did that on top of Corpuz holing from 12 feet. So effectively what's happened here is that Shiganda and Lynn Grant won against Angel Ying and Ali Ewing by 4-2. Pedersen and Stark tied with Jennifer Kupcho and Alison Corpuz in a match that didn't look likely to be tied, let alone, you know, come down to the 18th. Maguire and Georgia Hall, terrific match against Lexi Thompson and Lilia View. With that chip-in birdie in the last, Leona Maguire won the match with Georgia Hall against Thompson and View. And Gemma Drybera and Madeline Sagstrom in the top match, they tied with Rose Zhang and Megan Kang, largely because, mind you, it's a team effort, but Gemma Drybera holed from 50 yards on the 16th for what ended up being a half, but it was critical in earning a half match. So after the absolute, you know, shocker of the foursomes this morning, which America won all four matches, Europe are right back in it because they've won the four ball session by 3 points to 1, 2 wins, 2 halves, and the Americans didn't win any more matches other than the foursomes that they won this morning. fantastic day's play.
Oh, it sounds like it was brilliant. And Leona, right in her natural habitat, that competitive edge coming out, it sounds like.
Oh, completely. And, you know, the one thing was that this morning when she was playing with Anna Nordqvist, Anna Nordqvist didn't have a great day off the tee. She put two balls into basically lost ball situations. And obviously, you know, it's very hard to do that in foursomes because it's every alternate shot. And the next player, which is Leona Maguire, takes the next shot after the bad shot has been hit. So, look, Leona Maguire played well this morning. She put it great. She put it great this afternoon as well. And by goodness, does she have heart. And she has helped hugely. She, obviously, with that put in the, that chip in on the 18th, Emily Pettison with a hole-in-one, Gemma Drybrough with a 50-yard pitch that goes into the hole. Those are the things that you need to inspire a comeback. And Europe had that inspiration, especially from those three players. But Carlotta Chaganda and Lynn Grant won't get enough credit for what they did. They dominated their match in the bottom match, and they won it by 4-2. And that also was critical because it had blue on the board early in the four balls for Europe. They could look to Grant and also to Chaganda to say they're going to win that match. Let's do something to back that up, and they did. And Europe take three of the four ball points, and they're back in this. The match is now 5 points to America, 3 to Europe going into day two.
Okay, Greg, thank you so much for that. Now, Greg did mention how amazing Leona's finish was. Let's hear it.
The expecting crowd in the distance is going to move left to right.
Do it.
She's held it. Oh, magnificent from Leona Maguire. She would be disappointed with that first pitch. It sucked back to the front of the green, but then she holds it. A stunning Solheim Cup debut 2 years ago in Ohio. Oh, absolutely unbelievable stuff from Leona Maguire.